Okay, I'm going to pick up where we left off in the book of Jeremiah. We left off in chapter 39. And this chapter 39, it's actually going to be the climax in terms of the destruction of Jerusalem that we're going to be reading about, that Jeremiah and Ezekiel had so warned the people what was going to happen because of the people just not obeying God, not believing God, not listening to Him, and obviously that this is going to be the end result. But before I even do that, I just wanted to read something from Ezekiel to kind of preface this chapter 39 in Jeremiah in regards to the fall of Jerusalem, because God was dwelling there in the temple, Solomon's temple, and that's where His presence resided, right there above the cherubim, or above the Ark of the Covenant. And you can see that diagram I made of the temple there, but what's interesting to me is what Ezekiel had said in chapter 10 when Ezekiel was in exile. He said he saw a vision of God as God took him there to the temple area and showed him what happened in regards to God departing from the temple and actually departing from Jerusalem, because in Ezekiel chapter 10 verse 4 it says, "Then the glory of the Lord went up from the cherub to the threshold of the temple, and the temple was filled with the cloud, and the court was filled with the brightness of the glory of the Lord." And then he goes on to say in his chapter 10, "Then the glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple and stood over the cherubim. When the cherubim departed, they lifted their wings and rose from the earth in my sight with the wheels beside them, and they stood at the entrance of the east gate of the Lord's house, and the glory of the Lord of Israel hovered over them." And then it goes on to say, "As for the likeness of their faces, they were the same faces of those of whose appearance I had seen by the river Chebar. Each one went straight ahead. Moreover, the Spirit lifted me up and brought me to the east gate of the Lord's house, faced eastward, and behold, there were 25 men." Anyway, what I was trying to say here is this. It's that Ezekiel gets a vision of God departing from the temple. What I thought was very interesting about that was that Ezekiel described it as God just... His presence went outside the temple, onto the right side of the temple, then it went towards the threshold of the temple, and then it went above the east gate, and it just hovered there. And then how Ezekiel describes that the Lord goes to the Mount of Olives, and there the presence of the Lord departs. And what I glean from that is you see a real reluctance on the part of God to depart from His people. I mean, they have just now forced Him to this place where now their sins and their rebellion and their hostility towards Him has now just forced Him to depart. Yeah.
When you say that's where God's presence was in the, above the Ark of the Covenant, that's He wasn't contained to that space.
Oh, of course not. But here's the thing, all right? Understand this. God is everywhere. His Spirit just fills the universe, all right? Heaven and earth. However, He did manifest Himself in a very, very unique way in terms of His presence being there. Just like right now, Jesus Christ said, "Where two or more are gathered in my name, there I am in the midst of you." Well, His presence is in our midst right now in a very unique way. If we weren't gathered in His name, He wouldn't be in our midst at this moment. You see what I'm saying? Sure, He could be in our heart, all right, but He's talking about being in our midst. That means that that where we gather in His name, His Spirit is uniquely manifested in regards to His presence. So that's the same thing in regards to how His presence basically resided over the mercy seat of the Ark of the Covenant. And then now you see from what Ezekiel said how he begins to depart. And I only wanted to preface this chapter 39 with that, because now Jerusalem is going to be destroyed. The temple is going to be destroyed. And this is a long time in coming in regards to how Jeremiah for almost 40 years predicted that this would happen if these people did not turn from their sins and turn back to God and start obeying Him. And I'm telling you right now, this is not just ancient history. This isn't something that just happened 2,700 years ago, and it has no relevance in our life today. This is not just a bunch of useless information, a bunch of boring, bland, dry history that has no relevance to us. This is given to us as our example, and I cannot help when I read the prophets, especially, you know, the major prophets, I cannot help but see that God doesn't change. He's the same yesterday. He's the same today. He'll be the same tomorrow. And I could see that the glory of the Lord is departing from this country. Right, there's no question in my mind about that. it is really departing from this country, because we have just really blasphemed his name 24/7. We've given him our collective middle finger. We have been at war with him for decades now. You know, we've thrown him out of our schools and out of our courts. You can't mention his name anywhere. You can't even set up a nativity scene without somebody having a fit. I mean, virtually every time open a paper, there's something there to show more hostility towards God in regards to trampling underfoot his moral laws and his statutes and his ordinances, and just making a complete mockery of the Bible. And I'm telling you, God brought the judgment on his people when they began to act with such hostility towards them, and I can guarantee he's doing the same thing to this country right now. So beginning this verse 1 of chapter 39 of Jeremiah, it says, "Now when Jerusalem was captured in the ninth year of Zedekiah the king of Judah, in the tenth month, Nebuchadnezzar king of Babylon and all of his army came to Jerusalem and laid siege to it. And in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the fourth month, in the ninth day of the month, the city wall was breached." In other words, what this is saying to us is that this was a siege that lasted for 18 months, because in this verse 1, it says it came under siege in the ninth year of Zedekiah, on the 10th month, and then it says in the 11th year of Zedekiah, in the 4th month. So it's an 18-month siege that's taken place here, and there was only a slight respite from this siege when the Babylonian army just picked up. They left the city, they left the siege in order to confront the king of Egypt, and then once they destroyed his army, they came back for this siege. And here's the thing. This was an 18-month siege. Now, God could have easily just had the whole city just overrun in 18 minutes. But the thing went on for 18 months. And what that shows to me is this. Not only God's long-suffering, all right, and his patience, and he's trying to get these people to just, you know, finally get the message and get on their knees and repent and turn back to God. Nothing God could do to these people seemed to be able to change their hearts. And I'm telling you right now, I look at this country and I would say that we are under siege. Now, granted, we're not under siege in a sense that we've got armies or barbarians at the gates in terms of we're being overrun by armies, but we are under siege with just a multitude of problems that we can't solve. We're under siege from nature. We're under siege in regards to our economy. We're just under siege. And yet, somehow, some way, we're not getting it through our thick heads that this is the hand of God trying to wake us up. Same thing with these people here, right? And so that verse 2 of Jeremiah chapter 39 says, "In the 11th year of Zedekiah, the fourth month, in the ninth day of the month, the city wall was breached. Then all the officials of the king of Babylon came and sat down at the middle gate, Nergal-Sarezer, Samgar-Nebo, Sarsekim, the Rapsarsis, Nergal-Sarezer, the Rabmag, and all the rest of the officials of the king of Babylon." Now, in other words, when the walls were breached, these people came in, and then they were basically planning out their strategy. And apparently, from what Josephus tells us, this was in the middle of the night that they finally breached the wall, and then they got together with all the generals and their officials, and they were just planning out their next move. So in verse 4 it says, "When Zedekiah the king of Judah and all the men of war saw them, they fled and went out of the city at night by way of the king's garden through the gate between the two walls, and he went out towards the Arabah. But the army of the Chaldeans pursued them and overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and they seized him and brought him up to Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, at Riblah in the land of Hamath, and he passed sentence on him. And then the king of Babylon slew the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes at Riblah, and the king of Babylon also slew all the nobles of Judah. And then he blinded Zedekiah's eyes and bound him in fetters of bronze to bring him to Babylon. The Chaldeans also burned with fire the king's palace and the houses of the people, and they broke down the walls of Jerusalem. As for the rest of the people who were left in the city, the deserters who had gone over to him, and the rest of the people who remained, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the body guard, carried them into exile in Babylon. But some of the poorest people who had nothing, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, left behind in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at that time." Now, this is the climax, like I said, of what the prophets had foretold was going to happen. And this whole situation with Zedekiah, Jeremiah had told him over and over and over again that he was going to end up going to Babylon. And Ezekiel was in Babylon at this particular time because he went in one of the first waves of the deportation. And he was there, and God used him as a prophet to even write to Zedekiah and tell him that this was going to happen. But what's interesting is that this is what Ezekiel said in one of his letters to Zedekiah. And it's in Ezekiel chapter 12. This is what God says. He says, the prince, now this is Zedekiah, the prince who is among them will load his baggage on his shoulder in the dark and go out, and they will dig a hole through the wall to bring it out, and he will cover his face so that he cannot see the land with his eyes. I will also spread my net over him, and he will be caught in my snare, and I will bring him to Babylon in the land of the Chaldeans, yet he will not see it, though he will die there. Now that's interesting, is that Ezekiel said that he was going to go to Babylon, but he said he wouldn't see Babylon. He wouldn't see it. And then Jeremiah kept saying to Zedekiah that he was going to go to Babylon. And I think it's kind of interesting that in the writings of Josephus, he makes mention of this, of what had happened there, because he said in his writings, he said, now as to Zedekiah himself, while he heard the prophet speak, now he's talking about Jeremiah here, he believed him and agreed to everything as true, and supposed it was for his advantage, but then his friends perverted him and dissuaded him from what the prophet advised. In other words, the prophet was advising that Zedekiah surrender. If he would surrender to the king of Babylon, then he could spare his life. And even though Zedekiah believed him, Zedekiah's advisors kept saying, no, no, don't do that. And then Josephus goes on to say, that Ezekiel also foretold in Babylon what calamities were coming upon the people, which when he heard, he sent accounts to them to Jerusalem, but Zedekiah did not believe their prophecies for the following reason. It happened that the two prophets agreed with one another in what they said as to all the other things, that the city should be taken and Zedekiah himself should be taken captive. But Ezekiel disagreed and said that Zedekiah should not see Babylon, while Jeremiah said to him the king of Babylon should be carried away thither in bonds. And because they did not both say the same thing as to this circumstance, he disbelieved what they both appeared to be to agree. In other words, Josephus just explains it to us in this sense. And Josephus was a first century Jewish historian. He's just simply saying that Zedekiah was getting the message from both Ezekiel and from Jeremiah, to saying, hey man, you need to surrender and you're going to end up going to Babylon. But Ezekiel, I just read it here, said that you're not going to see Babylon. And so now what we just read here in this chapter 39 of Jeremiah, it tells us why he didn't see Babylon. It's because he had his eyes gouged out, and then he was dragged over there in chains, in bronze chains, and that's where he died. Now this Zedekiah, this was a man who was just a double-minded man. In other words, he knew that Jeremiah was a prophet of God, but he would not submit to what God was telling him to do, because he had seemed to have more fear of men than he did of God. You know, every time that Jeremiah would tell him that he needs to obey God, then Zedekiah's advisors would tell him otherwise, and then he'd be constantly vacillating back and forth. But look at the guy's end. It was a pretty terrible end, but the last thing that he saw on earth was his sons being murdered before his eyes, being killed before his eyes, and then they gouged out his eyes. Now that must have been really a painful thing to have to endure, not just having your eyes gouged out, but now you've gone from, you know, a king to being reduced to this kind of humiliation and disgrace. And all the while, he could have avoided the whole thing if he just obeyed God. And I'm telling you right now, this is what's going to happen to so many of our political leaders today. And I don't mean they're going to have their eyes gouged out and their family slain before them. But what I do mean is there's a tremendous judgment in store for the politicians of this nation. So what happened here, it was almost as though this was poetic justice, because Zedekiah has his eyes gouged out, poetic in terms of his judgment, because how many times did Christ say, you know, he who has an ear to hear, let him hear. And then when Christ said, I have come to make the seeing blind and the blind seeing. In other words, if people refuse to see what God is saying, and they refuse, you know, to look at what God is declaring, then as a judgment, he gets his eyes gouged out. And I'll tell you right now, this is what's going to come upon the whole world, because the whole world is going to be plunged into darkness at the very, very end of the world. In my opinion, it's going to be for 3 days. And it's almost poetic in its nature too, because Jesus said, you know, men prefer darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. So now the rest of his life, Zedekiah is walking around in darkness because he chose darkness. You see the poetic justice there? Now, just winding us down to this chapter 39, it says in verse 11, "Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave orders about Jeremiah through Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, saying, 'Take him and look after him and do nothing harmful to him, but rather deal with him just as he tells you.' So Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, sent word along with Nebuchadnezzar, the Rabsarses, and Nergal-Sarezer, the Ragmag, and all the leading officials of the king of Babylon." Now, these people were obviously the generals and the officials and the leaders. And also, when he's talking about the Ragmag, I think it's talking about, even the officials over their occultic priests. And then he says in that verse 14, "And they sent and they took Jeremiah out of the court of the guardhouse and entrusted him to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, to take him home. So he stayed among the people." Now, just get this picture here. When Zedekiah and his arm, well, basically what was left of his men, when they escaped from Jerusalem, when it finally got, the walls were finally breached and the enemy was inside the city, Zedekiah had this secret passageway by his palace where he was able to escape out from the city, and it was at night, and he heads towards Jericho, and Jericho is about 6, 7, 8 miles from Jerusalem, and there they capture him. But then they take him all the way up to Riblah, is where it's talking about. But Jerusalem is about 200 miles from Riblah, and that's where Nebuchadnezzar was staying. And I don't know why he was there, other than I can take two educated guesses. One is that he didn't want to be so far away from his from Babylon, from his palace, in case he had some kind of emergency where he had to turn around and head back to Babylon for whatever reason. Or he was just simply on his way to Jerusalem, but that's where he was 200 miles from Jerusalem. So they just hauled Zedekiah up there with his entourage and with his sons, and that's where they killed him. But then, when Nebuchadnezzar's up there, he gets word about Jeremiah through some of his officials, probably even Nebuzaradan, where I'm sure what had happened there was that when people would defect from the city and they would go over to the Babylonians and surrender, that they were telling the Babylonians, well, there's a prophet of God in there by the name of Jeremiah, and he keeps telling everybody that they need to surrender, and that that God is going to give this city over to the Babylonians. So Jeremiah was well known among the Babylonians. And so when Nebuchadnezzar got all wind of all this, then he wanted Jeremiah to be treated totally differently, because he tells us right here in that verse 11, "Now Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, gave orders about Jeremiah through Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, saying, 'Take him and look after him and do nothing harmful to him, but rather deal with him just as he tells you.'" And look, Jeremiah was a faithful man of God for, 40 years, just preaching the same message to a people who are just hostile towards him and indifferent and apathetic and just in his face and the whole thing. But now, when everything comes down around their ears, God spares him. And I really do believe that this is what we see in God, that God always makes a distinction between those who serve him and those who don't. We are told that in Malachi. We are told that all throughout Scripture. Even when God brought upon the Egyptians one plague after another, God made a distinction between his people dwelling in Goshen and the people of Egypt, that his people didn't come under these type of plagues. Well, he spared his prophet in the midst of all this, right? And I think what's also interesting is now, look at this verse 15. "Now the word of the Lord had come to Jeremiah while he was confined in the court of the guardhouse, saying, 'Go and speak to Ebed-Melets, the Ethiopian, saying, Thus saith the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, Behold, I am about to bring my words on this city for disaster and not for prosperity, and they will take a place before you on that day, but I will deliver you on that day, declares the Lord, and you will not be given into the hand of the men whom you dread. For I will certainly rescue you, and you will not fall by the sword, but you will have your own life as booty, because you have trusted in me, declares the Lord. Now that's very interesting to me, because you remember last week when we read about this Ebed-Melech, he was basically a eunuch who was overseeing the harem of King Zedekiah. But when Ebed-Melech had heard that Jeremiah was thrown into a well and to die, he rescued him from that. And as a result, God is going to spare his life. Now, here's the thing people got to understand too, all right? We get told over and over again in Scripture that God is no respecter of persons. He does not see the color of a person's skin. He does not see whether they are male or female, whether they are rich or poor, whether they are young or old or thin or fat. He doesn't look at the outward appearance of a person. He always gazes right through their flesh and into their soul. And what does he see? Like I said, so many times today we are living in a society where people just love to play the race card. And I'm telling you, that's something that cannot be played in the presence of God. Because God is no respecter of persons. In Christ, there's neither, what we're told in Galatians, that there's neither male nor female, there's neither Greek nor Jew, there's neither barbarian or Scythian, there's neither black nor white. You just throw it out there. God does not see in these colors. Now, here this Ebed-Melech, what did he do? He saved God's prophet. And Jesus Christ said very clearly in the New Testament that if we so much as give a cold glass of water in Christ's name, to the least of his brethren, it would not lose its reward. So God doesn't forget these things. And so he spares this man's life. Now, when I read this, I'm not sure if what happened to this eunuch was that when it says here in that verse 17, but I will deliver you on that day, declares the Lord, and you will not be given into the hand of the men whom you dread, for I will certainly rescue you, and you will not fall by the sword, but you will have your own life as booty. I don't know if that implies that his life was spared, but he had to go into exile. But when I read that 17, I get this impression. He was just let go. He didn't have to go into exile. Most of the people ended up dying by the sword when the Babylonians breached the city wall. And the only people that were really spared were the people that surrendered. Well, this guy here, I get this impression in that verse 17 that he was just set free. That he didn't even go into exile, because that verse 17 says that I will deliver you on that day, declares the Lord, and you will not be given into the hand of the men whom you dread. So in other words, it doesn't look like he was taken captive, but that verse 18, it kind of leaves it a little ambiguous, because it says, but you will have your own life as booty. So either way, his life was spared, but I kind of get the impression that he not only was spared, his life was not only spared, but he was just set free. He was a free man, just like Jeremiah was. Anybody have anything you want to add or share to that chapter 39? To me, it's almost anticlimactic in a sense, because this has been building and building and building and building through this virtually this entire book of Jeremiah in regards to the coming destruction on the city. And then here it is, in less than 20 verses, we read about this destruction. And actually, it's less than 10 verses for what happened to this city when the boom finally came. And I just can't help but, when I read this, see this very clearly, this is going to happen to us as a nation, that we too are going to come under severe judgments, because I cannot imagine for one split second that the people of Jerusalem during Jeremiah's day were worse than we are today in this country, as far as our morality and as far as our hostility towards God and our apathy and our indifference. And we're just flat out at war with God in many respects. Well, let's just wind this down by reading this chapter 40, then we've got plenty of time. It says, the word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord after Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard, had released him from Ramah, when he had taken him bound in chains among all the exiles of Jerusalem to Judah who were being exiled to Babylon. So you see what happened here is that Jeremiah was actually put in chains, and he was going to be led off into exile. But it was Nebuchadnezzar that said, I want this man free. He's not going to be in prison. And then it says in verse 2, now the captain of the bodyguard had taken Jeremiah and said to him, the Lord your God has promised this calamity against this place. And the Lord has brought it on and done just as he had promised, because you people sinned against the Lord and did not listen to his voice. Therefore, this thing has happened to you. Now look at that. This is the captain of the bodyguard of Nebuchadnezzar. This Nebuchadnezzar. Now this guy's a pagan. This guy's a heathen. All right. This guy's a Babylonian. But look what he says here. And it, to me, it says a lot, because that verse 2, now the captain of the bodyguard had taken Jeremiah and said to him, the Lord your God has promised this calamity against this place. Now where did he get that information?
Jeremiah, probably.
I believe it's because Jeremiah kept telling the people, you need to surrender because God is going to do this to the city. And so the ones that surrendered and they went over to the camp of the Babylonians, they undoubtedly told him this. But now, isn't it interesting? Here you got a pagan, an infidel, who believes God. But God's own people don't believe it. Go figure. It's like the very people who should believe are very often the most obstinate. What happened to Jesus Christ? The very people who should have believed were his biggest opposers, right? Well, this says here, the Lord your God has promised his calamity against this place, and the Lord has brought it on and done just as he promised, because you people sinned against the Lord and did not listen to his voice. Therefore, this thing has happened to you. Okay, verse 4. But now, behold, I am freeing you today from the chains which are on your hands. And if you would prefer to come with me to Babylon, come along, and I will look after you. But if you would prefer not to come with me to Babylon, never mind. Look, the whole land is before you. Go wherever it seems good and right for you to go. As Jeremiah was still not going back, he said, go on back then to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, who the king of Babylon has appointed over the cities of Judah, and stay with him among the people, or else go anywhere it seems right to you to go. So the captain of the bodyguard gave him a ration and a gift, and he let him go. Now this is what happens to God's prophet. I mean, God just really protected him in every way. He was going to be hauled off with the rest of the people. But look, God intervened, spared him, and then he says, hey, you can do whatever you want. You can come with me to Babylon, or the whole land's before you, go wherever you want. And Jeremiah was kind of hesitant there, so the captain of the bodyguard just says, well, why don't you go over to the Gedaliah, who's been appointed governor of your people, and then he gives him a ration and a gift. And then Jeremiah apparently just leaves him there and then goes to Gedaliah, because it says in that verse 6, then Jeremiah went to Mizpah, to Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, and stayed with him among the people who were left in the land. Now, here's the thing. Who were the people left in the land? Who remembers what we read in chapter 39? Who did they leave in the land?
It's the poorest and the least.
Yeah. In that verse 10 of chapter 39, it says, but some of the poorest people who had nothing, Nebuchadnezzar and the captain of the bodyguard left behind in the land of Judah and gave them vineyards and fields at that time. Now, that was kind of a wise thing to do. Why do you think that's such a wise thing for him to do? Well, this is my take on it here. The poorest in the land probably were the uneducated and the unskilled in many ways, many respects, right? So Nebuchadnezzar and Nebuchadnezzar feels like, well, I'm not going to drag all these people over to Babylon and just have them be put on a welfare program. I'm going to have them stay here, till the land, all right, and farm the land, because now the land won't be overrun with, let's say, wild beasts or animals or enemies or anything like that. But at the same time, the land will begin to produce its fruit, and they will tax these people. You see, I think it's a pretty wise thing, personally. But in God's economy, you can almost see it too, because Jesus Christ said that the meek shall inherit the earth. What I mean by that is you can see that coming in the future when Christ does return. It's going to be the lowly of the land. All right, not necessarily poor, but it's going to be the lowly, the humble. They're the ones that are going to inherit the earth. God's just going to do away with unrepentant sinners, and when he sets up his kingdom. Well, I think it was pretty a wise thing to do, to leave some people in the land to cultivate the land, and they could probably tax it now. They would be vassals. They would be under a governor, and they would have their freedom, but they would still be, in a sense, ruled or dominated by a foreign power. Then Jeremiah goes back to stay with Gedaliah. And then it says in verse 7 of chapter 40 of Jeremiah, says, now all the commanders of the forces that were in the field, they and their men, heard that the king of Babylon had appointed Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, over the land, and that he put him in charge of the men, women, and children, those of the poorest of the land who had not been exiled to Babylon. So they came to Gedaliah at Mizpah, along with Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and Johaniah, and Johaniah, the sons of Kareah, and Sariah, the son of Tanhum myth, and the sons of Ephi, the Nephilite, and Jezaniah, the son of the Maccathite, both they and their men. And Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, swore to them and to their men, saying, "Do not be afraid of serving the Chaldeans. Stay in the land and serve the king of Babylon, that it may go well with you. Now as for me, behold, I am going to stay at Mizpah to stand for you before the Chaldeans who come to us. But as for you, gather in wine and summer fruit and oil and put them in your storage vessels and live in your cities that you have taken over. Likewise also all the Jews who are in Moab and among the sons of Ammon and Edom and who were in all the other countries heard that the king of Babylon had left a remnant for Judah and that he had appointed over them Gedaliah the son of Ahikam, the son of Shaphan, and then all the Jews returned from all the places which they had been driven away and came to the land of Judah to Gedaliah at Mizpah and gathered in wine and summer fruit in great abundance." Now, this is what's kind of interesting to me is now, this is how merciful God is. The poorest of the land now are there, and it's almost as though God is just giving this small little remnant one more chance to see if these people now are going to obey him. And apparently they have it pretty good. And then the word goes out to a lot of the Jews who had basically fled Judah, who had fled from Jerusalem, and they went down to the country of the Moabites and to the Ammonites. And then when they heard that Nebuchadnezzar had pulled up stakes and went back to Babylon, then they came back. They came back to Judah and to basically get back to their land. And in a way, they were given a second chance, given a second opportunity. But as this Jeremiah begins to unfold, we're going to see that these people, too, are just going to end up being total rebels against God. Go figure. It's like it just you just shake your head in total disbelief, you know, that God would give these people so many different chances. But look at this verse 13 now. Now, Johanan, the son of Korea, and all the commanders of the forces that were in the field came to Gedaliah at Mizpah and said to him, "Are you aware that Baalis, the king of the sons of Ammon, has sent Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, to take your life?" But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, did not believe them. Then Johanan, the son of Korea, spoke secretly to Gedaliah in Mizpah, saying, "Let me go and kill Ishmael, the son of Nethaniah, and not a man will know. Why should he take your life so that all the Jews who are gathered to you would be scattered and the remnant of Judah would perish?" But Gedaliah, the son of Ahikam, said to Johanan, the son of Korea, "Do not do this thing, for you are telling a lie about Ishmael." Now, this kind of sets the stage for next week when we read this chapter 41 and 42 about what's going to happen after Gedaliah is going to lose his life. Now, Gedaliah was placed there as a governor, but this man, he was probably, impresses me as being a somewhat of a godly man, but he's not a leader, and he's not a real good administrator in this respect. Nebuchadnezzar just put him in charge there, but this guy, he's too trusting. In other words, he's being told right up front that, you know what, you've been marked for assassination. And he just doesn't believe what he's being told. And this is going to set the stage for the remnant of the people to end up revolting against God themselves because they're going to lose this leader. I mean, some people, in my opinion, they really are lacking when it comes to seeing through a matter. A good leader is somebody who can who has enough wisdom and insight where they can see through things. And this is Gedaliah obviously did not. He was too gullible. He was too trusting. And as a result, he's going to lose his life. But that in itself could end up being what we're going to see is it going to end up being a judgment in a sense that it's going to really expose the hearts of these people. In other words, it's going to be a test for these people, whether they're going to be obedient to God or not. Does anybody have anything you want to add or share to this Jeremiah chapter 40?